private sector that has an interest in these kind of projects, our regional integration projects. So I'll run through a number of slides that basically share our philosophy in the African Development Bank, how we approach support for regional projects, PDA type projects, and some of the instruments that are available to support the early stage development of projects, but also the investment phase, and also other forms of support that the bank is able to provide. So I'll start sharing my presentation with you now, and then after that, there'll be a question and answer session. So the presentation basically has six parts. Firstly, just quickly what the bank does, which I'm sure you're all aware of, but as a quick recap. I'll share with you how we prioritize regional projects for financing within the bank, and I'm sure it's similar maybe for other MDBs, pretty much. Some of the solutions that we have for project preparation and development, as we are aware, a lot of the PDA projects still need some kind of preparatory work, studies. Some of the solutions that we have for financing public sector projects, and I'll talk a bit more about what we mean by that in the bank, and also private sector and PPP projects, and then some quick recommendations on how we can accelerate financing of PDA projects once the PAP 2 is adopted in January next year. So the bank, the African Development Bank, we see ourselves as being more than just a bank, because you know, we provide a lot more support than what a normal bank per se would do, which is focused on transactions and focused on returns. As you know, the bank has been in existence for more than 50 years. Its shareholding and support includes all the 54 African countries. And the bank leverages both public and private structure, in other words, able to support purely economic projects from the public sector, governments and government agencies, but also projects that are in partnership or led by private sector. The bank has a AAA credit rating, which enables it to be able to source financing from capital markets at good rates, and be able to on very concessional terms to its member countries in Africa for development purposes. And our interest really as a bank is focused on the countries, our member countries, development priorities, and also on the projects. We aim to try and select projects that have highest impact when we compare similar projects. So that's really where we focus our attention, other than maximizing returns. And we're able to provide financing for both sovereign or public sector projects, government-led projects, but also private sector projects. But also, in addition to that, be able to extend special guarantees and instruments, which I'll share with you in the course of this presentation. So, quickly, what the bank provides, which you may be aware, we are able to provide grants for technical assistance and for PDA type projects. This can be a very important facility because some of the projects require expertise within the executing agencies to help the countries or get the projects to move from a concept or an idea as a concept. Through early stage pre-feasibility work, more detailed feasibility and technical studies, as well as through to securing financing. So these grants can also support enabling environment, and for PDA projects, this is very important because being multinational projects, we normally always would like to have an institutional framework that is very clear to enable the project to actually make progress. We also provide, obviously, financing, loans, grants for investments, but also equity. The bank does also make equity investments in certain operations that we support. And in addition to that, to mitigate risks, we provide what we call risk mitigation instruments and products, but also guarantees that may help a project become more attractive for private sector investment or participation. In terms of our lending operations, we have projects or what we call a public window. This is financing for public sector projects, but also what we call a private window or instruments that are intended to support private sector investment. For public sector window, the recipients will normally be governments or government-owned enterprises, parastatals or state-owned enterprises. And for private window, the recipient of financing would normally be privately owned enterprises, or at times financially strong public enterprises. So, for example, we have provided financing to entities, for example, in South Africa, like Eskom, the power utility, or Transnet, the rail and port management authority in South Africa, which are publicly owned, but because they are commercially operating independent of government financing, we're able to provide financing to them through the private sector window as well, and also in other countries where we are able to do that. Guarantees, obviously I talked about that. This could be sovereign, in other words, backed by government support, or non-sovereign guarantees, so basically purely on the commercial aspects of the project that is being led or promoted by a private party. And the terms, obviously, for public sector projects are very concessional to enable the investment and development to take place. And for the private window, we have terms that are more commercial, but still we believe that our terms would, in the private sector case, still be more competitive than a purely, for a profit-oriented commercial bank or investment bank. So how do we prioritize projects? Obviously, PIDA is the overarching continental initiative, and all the regional projects that we seek to support in the bank have to be checked against the PIDA priority action program. So that's really like the first upper layer of saying, okay, we have this project to support. It's a transport project, an energy project. It's a regional project. Is it a priority in PIDA? If yes, then definitely it receives the highest priority. The next level, because it's not just PIDA projects, obviously, that qualify for financing. There are the regional projects that are in regional infrastructure master plans, but may not be in PIDA. So that is the second level in terms of prioritization. Is it in a regional infrastructure master plan, either in West Africa, Southern Africa, East or North? And sometimes these regional master plans are at the sector level. So as you are aware, some of the regs within some of the regions, you have also specialized infrastructure institutions like the power pools or the corridor management organizations or the regional river basin organizations. So that's kind of like the second level at the regional level to say, is this project, if it's not in a regional infrastructure master plan, is it a priority for a sub-regional specialized institution, either for energy, transport, water? The second level of assessment is really the cooperation agreements. And as you will note, for PDAPAP 2, one of the requirements for submission is to ensure that there's actually an MOU, an existing agreement, wherever possible between the member countries that are cooperating on the project. And this is key because it is a demonstration to us that the project is actually being undertaken in agreement of all the countries that are party to that project. And then we do look at the other financial and economic viability assessments if they are available. Sometimes very early on, before the project has any studies, it is not possible to have all this information available, but we do make early stage assessments of those as well. Of course, we also would want to assess environmental and social impacts. And the idea, again, is to be able to select projects that have the least negative impacts, or as we all know, possibly all projects do have some kind of impact. What are the mitigating arrangements around those impacts, potential impacts? One important criteria is the regional integration impact. So if this project is a regional integration project, what is the impact that this project is going to have compared to another, for example? How many of the citizens of these countries are going to benefit? What is the population that's likely to benefit? What would be the impact on intra-regional trade by implementing this project? And how will it reduce the cost of doing business within that sub-region? So these are all kind of assessments that we undertake to be able to quantify what potential impact implementing or sub-financing this project will have. And obviously, our prioritization will pick those that demonstrate the highest potential impact. And then, of course, readiness. And readiness is important because if a project does not qualify under our readiness criteria, it demonstrates the potential for problems downstream under the implementation phase of the project. So we do want to ensure that the project is ready in terms of, one, the institutional framework, all the agreements are in place between the countries, who is going to execute the project, what capacity do they have, do they need technical assistance to enhance their capacity, do they have PIUs, do they have the ability to prepare all the documentation and reporting required and to take financial management? So all these elements have to be assessed to ensure that they are adequate to make the project ready for financing. So as you will appreciate, most projects require preparation and even some of the projects already being received on the PDAPAP2 submission portal, a lot of them will still require some preparatory work to get them ready for investment. And the bank does have a number of solutions to support preparation of projects. And some of these are listed here. I know that the screen, the page is quite small font, so I do not intend you to try and read all of them, but just to demonstrate that there is multiple sources of project preparation that we have in the bank. Some are theme focused. For example, some of the climate funds are focused on the energy sector. And there are some that are multi-donor funds. A good example is the NEPAD Infrastructure Project Preparation Facility, the NEPAD IPPF, which I'll talk to a bit more in the subsequent slides, which is a multi-donor fund set up specifically to help the preparation of regional projects and particularly PDA projects. We do have other specific funds like the Africa Legal Support Facility, which I'm sure most of you have heard of or interacted with. This is specifically to support the provision of legal expertise on complex transactions that our member countries engage in. But also the ALSF does provide advisory services for PPP projects, transaction advisory services. So this is one area where also they are able to provide assistance. So there is quite a number of project preparation special funds within the bank, which can support preparation of PDA projects. And most times, because the financing requirements for preparation are quite significant, especially for PDA type projects, not one single project prep fund can fully take up the financing requirements for preparation, and we normally have to co-finance with other funds either within the bank or other sister funds are hosted outside of the bank. So a bit more focus on the NEPAD IPPF because it's specific for PDA projects in a sense. The core areas that it supports, it provides grants, currently still just grants that are not reimbursable for countries, directly to member countries, can be direct to regional economic communities or directly to power pools. These are the specialized institutions or river basin organizations or corridor agencies to be able to undertake the preparatories. The NEPAD IPPF supports a range of activities which begin at the early stage of preparation. So it could even start at the pre-feasibility. It's able to support undertaking full feasibility studies. These are economic, technical, social, and all the required feasibility to ensure that the project actually can move on to implementation, including providing support for design, engineering design, detailed design, and even preparation of bidding documents if the project is going to go out to bidding. They can get assistance for that. Also, environmental and social impact assessment studies, as well as providing transaction advisory services for PPP projects that have been decided to go into implementation under the PPP arrangement. So this is all a kind of a scope of activities or areas of support that the NEPAD IPPF can support. And the priority for NEPAD IPPF under its current strategic plan is first of all PDA projects, and then as I'd shown previously under the prioritization criteria, we cascade now to regional infrastructure master plan projects, and then priority projects of specialized institutions and so on. But PDA projects are at the heart of what NEPAD IPPF is set out to support. Moving on, the process to access financing for NEPAD IPPF, which I think will be important for a number of the projects that are being submitted that need preparation. There is an application process. There's a form, an application form that can be accessed either through its website or directly, which has to be completed. Once the application is received, it is screened in accordance to the criteria. To first check if it is eligible for support, and secondly, to assess its technical score in terms of the meeting the requirements needed to rank the project as a priority. So whether it's a it's in the PDA PAP, what are the prospects for funding, how ready is it, what kind of co-financing will be required, etc. The third stage of processing an IPPF grant would be the appraisal, where we'll undertake an appraisal validation, engage with the applicants to assess all the requirements needed. And then we process an information document for approval within the bank, which has a number of steps. And ultimately, once the grant is approved, the funds are made available for implementation of the preparation work. This process can take anything between 3 to 6 months, but NEPAD IPPF prepares an annual work program. So once the work program is approved, the focus is on those projects that have been approved, and other projects that may not have met the work program are included in the reserve list for possible carryover into the subsequent work program. That's kind of just a quick overview of the processing steps NEPAD IPPF grant for project preparation. Just a quick snapshot of so far, I mean, the NEPAD IPPF has been in existence now since 2001. So we're looking at, close to 20 years. So far, they have approved 92 projects, 6 regional projects, to be clear, they're only regional projects in the 4 sectors. Out of those, 60 have been completed, meaning the studies have been completed. We have 22 that are ongoing within the portfolio of the NEPAD IPPF. Of the projects that have been supported, the fund has had contribution from donors because it's a multi-donor fund, some of which are the governments of Canada, Germany, the UK, Spain, Norway, some of which have moved out, but some are still providing support. A total of amount of $109 million contributions for project prep, which has led to the projects that have secured financing of an amount in the equivalent of $25 billion. So this is quite a significant result area for us to show, because for the amount of money invested, it has led to a very large leverage effect in terms of the downstream investment. This talks to the importance of good preparation of projects. On the other side of the screen, I think it's just a demonstration of the breakdown of the projects that have been supported by sector and by type, by project type. But yeah, we can provide more information on this if necessary. And then also the point I was making about the leverage effect, it demonstrates so far that for every dollar that has been committed by NEPA IPPF, it has led to attracting about $861 in downstream financing. So this is quite significant for us to demonstrate the value of good project preparation, or the value and importance of investing in projects preparation early before a project can secure financing. Note that so far in the IPPS portfolio, the bulk has been energy sector projects. The bulk of investments received has been in the energy sector, about $21 billion over the past years that has been in operation. Transport sector coming second, and then IT and so on. And some of the projects that have been built are in all the regions and sectors on the continent. And this slide shows a few of them. I know it's very small font to read, but we have projects such as the OVG, Gambia-Senegal River Bridge, Nacala Corridor in Southern Africa, the Benin-Togo-Ghana Electricity Interconnection. In the energy sector is quite a lot. Ethiopia-Kenya Power Interconnector, Itezi-Tezi Hydropower in Southern Africa, Ethiopia, K3, etc. And the list goes on. So, I mean, these details are available on the NEPA IPPF website and through its annual reports that are published. So, solutions for public sector. So, we have covered pretty much an overview of what the African Development Bank does and is able to support, linked to regional projects and PIDA. I've talked about the importance of project preparation, because that's the only way. When projects are well prepared, we'll be able to secure the investment finance required downstream. And because projects that emerge from PIDA can either be public sector projects, or projects to be financed purely by the public sector governments, or can also be able to attract private sector. My next two levels of this presentation cover what solutions we have in the African Development Bank, and similar, I think, for other MDBs, to support either public sector projects and or private sector led or PPP type projects. So the African Development Bank has several windows of financing for investment in projects. We have a concessional instrument, which we call the African Development Fund. I'm sure most of you are aware of this. The concessional funds of the ADF is intended to support low investments in low-income countries in Africa. So countries are categorized based on their GDP strength, and are categorized either as middle-income countries or low-income countries, and there are a number of countries that are in between, which we call blend countries. So the ADF is a concessional fund that the bank makes available to particularly the low-income countries, because it is a concessional lending window. It comprises principally of grants and some very, very concessional soft loans to enable the countries to achieve their development objectives. And this is replenished every 3 years with resources from some of the partners, African member donor countries, I would say. But these are the international cooperating partners that provide funding to the ADF. So, like I said, the ADF provides concessional loans, and will usually have a grant element. And this is one of the resources that are available to support regional projects. In addition, through this ADF window, the bank created what we call a regional operations envelope. So 21%, I think 21% of this ADF every 3 years is carved out specifically to finance regional projects. So PDA projects would obviously be the main qualifying projects under infrastructure for this. But of course, the regional operations also cover other operations that are not infrastructure, but predominantly this regional envelope will finance infrastructure projects. So it is a very, very good option for regional projects under PDA to secure concessional financing if they are purely public sector led projects through the ADF with the regional envelope. And I can explain a bit more later how this works if it is of interest. So basically under, you know, when we look at infrastructure, the sectors are there: energy, transport, ICT, and water. The bank is able to structure financing based on the needs of the project. We can mix debt and equity investments, but also the bank provides financing through other infrastructure equity funds that are out there on the African market. The bank has investment in a number of those. Those infrastructure funds are special funds that are targeting investment in these sectors and subsectors of infrastructure. We can talk a bit more about that if it's of interest. For private sector or PPP type projects, the bank also has a number of financing instruments. So we obviously will be able to provide debts to the investors, terms that are quite good, attractive, I would say, compared to other purely profit-oriented organizations. And usually the tenor of such debt depends on the specificities of the project, but can be up to 15 years. And at times can have a grace period, repayment period of 5 years early. And normally the bank will support up to 1/3 of the total cost. This is a policy decision of the bank and is linked to, you know, its risk mitigation and AAA rating guidelines. So basically, that's senior debt, but also the bank is able to provide subordinated debt in partnership with other lenders. It's able to provide guarantees, partial risk guarantee is actually a very important instrument because if you are going to attract private sector investment in some of the projects we have, we need to reduce the perception of perceived level of risk in that investment to be able to attract financing through private sector sources. So the partial risk guarantee actually does provide a guarantee to any partners and lenders that should, the risks that have been identified in the project materialize, then the guarantee will kick in to mitigate that risk or reduce the impact of that risk. We also have what we call a partial credit guarantee. That's another guarantee instrument to try and crowd in more private sector investment. I did say that the bank also does invest in equity at times, and generally this can be indirect through a private equity funds that are also investing in infrastructure, or it can also be direct, and there's a guideline of a maximum of about 25% of the investment requirements there. Also for these private sector PPP projects, the bank is able to provide technical assistance as required. This could be grants for studies, for capacity support, but also, at times linked to, downstream SME programs that are linked to those specific infrastructure projects to stimulate local economies. So all these instruments are available depending on the needs of our member countries, but also the needs of the specific project. How do we assess PPP or private sector-led infrastructure projects? They have to meet four broad criteria. One is the strategic alignment. So the project itself must be in alignment with a country's economic and social priorities. So this project is being invested in a particular country X. The country has got its own national priorities. This project must be linked to that and not the outside. Secondly, the project must also align with the bank's own strategy. So the bank has obviously the high fives that we all know, which are the top level strategic priorities, development priorities for the bank, the Light Up and Power Africa, Feed Africa for Agriculture, Integrate Africa, which Peter falls in, the Regional Integration Objective. We have the Industrialize Africa to promote industrialization, as well as the improving the quality of life. So the project must align at least with one or more of these high-level strategic priorities. But also, we have sector strategies and policy priorities, and it must be able to show that it's aligned with that. Commercial viability, a PPP or private sector-led project must be able to demonstrate that it's commercially viable, because the sustainability of that project and its ability to repay any lending provided to it is linked to its ability to collect revenue, obviously. So we do look at the perspective and market fundamentals of that particular project, its financial structure, what is the track record of the sponsors, and what is the experience and financial strength. We will look at the projected cash flows and rates of return to be able to make a decision on the commercial viability of the project. Thirdly, the project must demonstrate development outcomes. So because we're a development bank, no matter how good a private sector-led project may be, it must be able to demonstrate development outcomes. So it must be able, for example, to demonstrate benefits that are going to be achieved by implementing the project at that national level. Is it going to create jobs? If so, how many? How many households are going to benefit from that investment? What impact will it have on fiscal revenues for the government, taxes, royalties, etc.? How about environmental and social issues? And then how is it going to accelerate or improve or spur private sector development and local SMEs in that country? So that's some of the development outcomes that we look out for. But these are not exclusive, but it has to demonstrate development outcomes. Then fourthly, our support to the project must demonstrate additionality. In other words, by the bank financing this project, what is the additionality that we are going to enable achieve under this project? So there may be a lot of areas. I talked about guarantees earlier. The partial risk guarantee, for example, can also mitigate against political risks. As you know, a lot of private investors will be sometimes wary of investing in certain countries or regions because of political risks. And the partial risk guarantee can guarantee against the impact of such a risk. And that's one additionality that we, as the African Development Bank, can provide to a project, and be able to mitigate that political risk through such a guarantee if it is structured in the project. The other thing is a catalytic role. At times we see that if we invest in a project, we then are able to bring on board other financiers on the comfort that the African Development Bank is there and is also able to provide these guarantees. So our involvement in the project can actually bring in additional financing. And that's one area of additionality that will be considered as a positive. So any private sector project, infrastructure project, or any other private sector-led project must be able to demonstrate these four broad areas that I just outlined. This slide shows you pretty much similar information, just maybe differently. I didn't mention that the project must be Africa-based. So any private sector investment must be located in Africa. I talked about commercial viability. I talked about development impacts. I talked about additionality and environmentally sound, etc. So this was already covered previously. So this brings me towards the end of my presentation. And the last slide is just basically kind of like recommendations. As we are submitting or putting together these PDAPAP 2 projects, we need to think about what is required to be able to secure financing. I think over my presentation, I've touched on a number of areas that need to be considered early on. I talked about how we prioritize projects. We need to make sure that the agreements are in place. We need to make sure that the project is ready, the institutional structure is in place. If the project requires project preparation, how quickly, how early do we start that activity? What is required? Does it need technical assistance? So all those early stage work to make the project ready are very important. And then once we go through the preparation, we're able to identify how the project can be structured, whether as a public sector project or as a PPP or private sector project, and therefore be able to target the relevant sources of financing that are, you know, amenable to the type of project. And so just a few points here. The advice that, you know, based on my experience, is start early on the upstream preparation. If countries are planning on a project, are cooperating on a project, start early on the upstream preparation. This saves you time later. For example, the MOUs, make sure they're in place, they, you know, by national, the country agreements, either supported by REC. If you are setting up a supranational agency, one good example we have right now is the Abidjan-Lagos Highway Corridor Project in West Africa. I think it involves five countries where they have set up a corridor authority. This is a good move, we think, because it brings all the countries to one place. And this corridor development authority has been mandated by each of the countries to secure financing and manage all the development of this highway, that's highway corridor. So we call this like a supranational agency. And we believe such kind of authorities actually accelerate implementation of projects. So if your project needs that, start early in putting together modalities and agreements between the countries to set up these this kind of agency. Project preparation, very key. As you have seen, good preparation leads to attracting financing, but also leads to early financial close. So we need to start early to structure the preparation of our project, make sure all the required studies are undertaken, seek financing from the African Development Bank and other partners, you know, who are able to provide project preparation. We've seen also an increased number of member countries putting money into their own projects. So it is not only financing from DFIs like ourselves, but also countries themselves do commit their own resources to prepare projects. This is critical to ensure the project can attract financing. Once the studies are underway, it's important to make a decision amongst the countries how they see this project. Is it going to be purely public sector finance, or there's a potential for a PPP approach in the project? And especially the PPP approach is amenable to projects that are very commercially viable, have got a potential revenue stream downstream. For example, if it's a toll road, it's got a potential to collect tolls as a revenue, or power projects have got potential to collect income through tariffs. So if the project has got a potential for PPP, it's important for the owners of this project to make a decision to explore the PPP viability on the project. This is essential because public sector financing alone is not adequate, as we know. And we need to blend financing as much as possible with the private sector sources. So if a project is attractive for PPP, that decision must be made early, and the countries must be able to secure support to structure that project as a PPP transaction to attract private sector investment. And just to conclude, I mean, the African Development Bank is here to support you, support African member countries, achieve their development objectives, and specifically achieve the objectives that are set up in PIDA and PIDA PAP 2. So thank you very much. This is where my presentation ends. And I'm sure we'll now be able to go into a Q&A session. So I don't know if Mike Salau is on the call yet. If not, perhaps Krishna, will you moderate the Q&A?
Yes. Thank you, Jirag. I don't see Mike yet, but we have a number of colleagues with us. Some task force members, Eunice, Christine. I can see Engeda is there, energy expert, and so I think we can start the question and answer session. Maybe Charlie, can you guide us on the questions in the? Are there any questions in the chat box?
Hi Krishna, thank you, Chair, for that interesting presentation. No, Krishna, there is actually no questions on the chat box. So perhaps colleagues, if you have any questions, you can raise your hand and then you can take the floor and have the discussion.
Okay, maybe if there are not any questions yet, maybe I can raise one actually. Gerard, I think there's a lot of, many of us are not specialized in finance. We are a bit far from this world. And as you know, with the current situation of what's happening in the world, first of all, the sanitary crisis, which is leading to an economic crisis, not yet a financial crisis, but at least an economic crisis. But the impact, maybe if you could comment a bit on what this will change in terms of the fundamentals, the exchange rates, devaluation of local currencies vis-a-vis hard currencies, dollars, euros, and then what would be the impact on the potential lending rates. I can see Mike is joining.
Right. No, that's a very, very important point, Krishna, that you raised. I think one thing that I didn't say in my presentation is that the bank also is able to lend in local currencies. So we do provide, obviously the bulk of the lending is in foreign currency, US dollars, euros. Of course, we use the unit of account in the bank, but also the bank is able to structure local currency lending in certain markets currently, not in all markets as yet, but this is an evolving situation. So that is also possible because it helps to mitigate the impact of foreign currency instability or repayment, the challenges of repaying foreign currency later. But yes, the impact of the current situation with the COVID pandemic is a critical situation. I think we and the rest of the world, I think we're still trying to understand how this will ultimately impact the business infrastructure. Of course, we know for now, most governments are having to divert their fiscal resources to support or mitigate or fight the pandemic. So basically, programs that were perhaps planned for or projections of internal revenue that were projected to go towards development projects is having to be diverted or focused on to health and sanitation to fight the pandemic. So that has a clear impact on the ability of most of our countries to achieve their development programs in infrastructure specifically and others, but also the focus of most development partners like ourselves at the moment has also been to try and support our countries with special resources put aside to support the fight against the pandemic. So of course that impacts the ability to achieve development programs that were planned for infrastructure. However, we are taking more detailed assessments to see the impact on infrastructure, and we're planning more of that at a macro level, meaning a broad continental level, multi-sector level. What is the impact that this is going to have on infrastructure currently, but also infrastructure investment downstream, and what measures or actions can be taken to help countries build back better after the impact. But also we are aware that actually infrastructure is an enabler. So there's a possibility also that infrastructure development might be able to structure or identify investments in infrastructure that will help to enable rebuilding the economies that are suffering as a result of the pandemic. But the full impact, I think, is still an ongoing work to be able to identify clearly where, how, and what form impact. You talked about interest rates, currencies, and so on. I think this is an evolving situation. But broadly, we feel that the impact is there. It's impacting investments in infrastructure because funds are being focused on fighting the pandemic and taking care of the lives of people. But we also think there's a potential to rebuild the sector, the infrastructure sector, as an enabler enhance economic growth post the pandemic. Mike is online. Mike, welcome. I just completed the presentation and we are in a Q&A. So I don't know if you would like to add to this specific question and any others that we might get. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. It's just to again say hi to colleagues and I'm happy to join. So it's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mchera. Thank you, Mike. There's two questions on the chat box, one from Monga. Monga is asking, how far is the work on the financial strategy that the bank is preparing? And the second question is from Peter. He's asking, is PIDA and specifically PIDA Pub 2 likely to be made a criteria for project preparation funding?
Right. So to quickly respond to those questions, Monga, yes. Hi, Monga. We are part of the PIDA Pub 2 task force together. We are working on developing a concept note and TORs for the PIDA Pub 2 financing strategy. This is a work in progress. I think the PIDA task force meets tomorrow, so we'll be able to update the team there. But we believe that this is an activity that will be completed in the next few weeks, and we'll be able to commence activities to procure a firm to help us put together the strategy. So I think we are on track to ensuring that the PIDA financing strategy is developed in time, definitely before the end of the year or before the governance organs of the African Union consider the proposed PAP for submission to the AU summit. And the PIDA financing strategy will help us to focus on how we can enhance opportunities for financing PIDA PAP 2 projects, learning from the experience of the PIDA phase one, which we are in currently. What are the lessons that have been learned? What have been the challenges? How can we structure financing for PIDA PAP 2 projects to ensure that they attract more and timely financing? And what special instruments perhaps may need to be put in place to support these PIDA PAP 2 projects? How can we bring in innovative financing mechanisms? Last time we talked about potential to use our natural resource endowment in Africa as a means of securing financing. So the financing strategy will have a broad overview of what the potential and opportunities are to be able to enhance financing for PIDA PAP 2 projects. The question about whether there will be special resources for PIDA PAP 2 preparation, again, I think this will emanate from the financing strategy, the work that will be done to prepare the financing strategy. But of course, the current project preparation instruments that we have, like the NEPAD IPPF I talked about, are still there and will be there to be one of the key project preparation funds to support PIDA PAP 2 projects. The key, of course, is to ensure that the fund is actually replenished sufficiently and strongly, and might I say, also through or from our own African member countries. This has been a key issue in terms of project preparation. That for years we have tended to look to donor countries to finance our project prep, and I think decisions have been taken in the past by African leaders to ensure that we have more African countries putting resources to prepare our own projects. And I think this will be a key feature of the PIDA financing strategy going forward.
Okay.
Okay, Jira, so allow me to reinforce your response on Peter's question, if PIDA or PIDA PAP 2 likely to be made a criteria. This is a very good point, and I think we must be very clear on that. In addition to what you said, yes, it will be. Priority is to really support PIDA PAP 2. So we must make it very clear that NEPAD IPPF priority is to support PIDA PAP 2. So as you are submitting, that's why we are fully involved in this exercise, so that we can drive PIDA PAP 2 to success. So we will be making this a high-level criteria for considering project preparation funding, that the project must be first and foremost contributing to PDAPAP 2 or part of the PDAPAP 2 list of priority projects. So that's very important. And our strategic objective is to move into about 75% of our grants or reimbursable grant or grant support to move to support PDAPAP 2. So this is a strategic objective for us, a milestone for us that we must achieve, having about 75% of our project supported PDAPAP 2. So that's very important. If I, Michelle, you want me to take the next question, the one that follows?
What's the next question, Charlie?
The one, I think it's Christine's question. Christine's question. Maybe you can.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you Charlie, want me to read it out loud?
Yes, please. What's the question?
Okay, so Christine is asking, why are the projects stuck at NEPAD IPPF level? Normally, as per the FDB presentation, the process should be done in 3 to 6 months. However, some PDAPAP 1 projects are still stuck there up to now. So why the process is taking longer than expected?
All right. Did you want to take that, Mike, or you want me to respond?
No, I mean, you can go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not sure what it means projects are stuck at NEPAD IPPF. The reality, though, is that, the NEPAD IPPF has limited resources. So every year we have a budget that is set aside to support preparation of projects. Every year we receive, maybe in excess of 20, 30 projects applications. And like I said, the NEPAD IPPF is not solely for PIDA, but it's primarily for PIDA. So our main focus is PIDA projects. But the fund does support other projects that are regional projects, have a good development impact, and meet all the criteria that we talked about. Obviously every year you prioritize the ones that you are able to finance that year. So it is not possible that we are able to finance everything that we receive, but we have a process where we have a pipeline that goes into several years beyond to, this particular year. Every year we prioritize a work program, so basically we select a representative list of projects that are sector balanced, so transport, energy, ICT, water, those are the sectors, but also regional focused. So we want to ensure a mix of projects in each region of Africa so that we don't have dominance of one particular region, but also ensure that the projects that are in the work program actually are prioritized, ranked based on their impacts, development impacts and prioritization. So those that don't make a particular work program year, like the 2020 work program year, will be in a reserve list. Reserve list, obviously, is projects that meet all the criteria and qualify, but are not in the top list prioritized for that particular year. And those will normally be carried over for prioritization of the subsequent work program. So obviously, as you will see, it's not that projects are stuck, but you can only do so much in a particular year, and then there's a subsequent move to the following year where projects can be supported. Now, NEPAD IPPF, of course, ensures to secure partners as well to co-finance projects, because like I mentioned earlier, the demands are huge, the needs are big, are significant, but the resources are not entirely adequate. So we need to be innovative in the way we secure partners for financiers. There are many other project prep funds on the continent, as a matter of fact, outside of the African Development Bank, from other MDBs, from multilaterals, from private. And we do have what we call the Project Preparation Facilities Network, which we coordinate in the bank, which is a network of all the project preparation facilities active in Africa in infrastructure. The whole idea is to try and coordinate better, identify co-financing opportunities so that we can achieve more investment. But the reality is that the NEPAD IPPF needs more resources, and I think we've been talking to our African leaders to ensure that sufficient replenishment is made so that the impact is bigger. We are in the process now of developing a new strategic business plan for the NEPAD IPPF, which will guide its operations over the next 5 years from 2021 to 2025. And the timing cannot be better, because that links directly to the approval of the PDAPAP 2. And we believe that in that new business strategy, which also includes a resource mobilization strategy, will define how the NEPAD IPPF should do more to support PDAPAP 2 over the next 5 to 10 years and going forward. And a lot of you here, present here, will be engaged and consulted as we prepare that business strategy, so that your input on how this fund can achieve more, you know, we should be taken into account. So I don't know if Mike, you want to add, but that's my quick response.
Yeah, just to say that, you know, to respond to Christine's question, in addition to what you said, there is no, to my knowledge, any project, PDAPAP 1 project stuck at NEPAD IPPF level. And the way we function is very clear, and I'm sure that was also presented. We do receive requests. So if you receive a request for a government or two governments, mostly government, original community to prepare a project, that's a very important process for us. That's what we do. So we have to take that on and then start acting upon. So you may see a lot of list of projects in PAP 1 with no request sent by any government. And that's something that we must also, you know, take into account in PAP 2. That's what we're saying. You know, government must be aware that when you put a project as a priority project, you must, at the end of the day, as we prepare also for integration. So we only act upon projects for which we have received requests. And when we do so, we process those projects. So in our book, we do not have any requests that are pending unless there are issues pertaining to enable environment, agreement between the countries to do projects, you know, those political bottlenecks that must be addressed, or a huge financing gap that stakeholders are not able to bridge. So those are two key things that can stop the project. You know, lack of political agreement on the project. We'll see that on some of the projects that we are already on the part two, which also part one. But or a huge financing gap to bridge operation funding. So those are two things that are very important we must consider as we submit the project either part two. That's why the financing strategy that we do is very clear on this point that not because you submit a project in PDAPAP 2 automatically will be financed. We have to think about how we prepare ourselves to fund the preparation so that it reaches its goals. So that's a very important aspect. I just want to show up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. The second two questions, one is coming from Sotera Yuneka. He's asking, could the bank explore a for a special window for PDAPAP 2 projects? PDAP projects need to be cushioned from competition for financing from other institutional projects. The other question is from Suela. What is the relation between AFDB and the NEPAD IPPF, and if all the PDAP projects are eligible for funding for preparation stage? Over to you, Mchara.
All right. Thanks, Charlie. And thanks, Sotera, my brother. I hope you're doing well. Good to hear you're in the call. Could the bank secure a special window for PDAP projects? Good question. And this issue has been debated and discussed. You will recall that when PDAP Phase 1 was approved in 2012, there was a decision to create a special facility to support PDAP projects. In fact, that is how Africa 50 emerged, where our former president, Dr. Kaberuka, went around, mobilized support from African leaders to create a new financing mechanism, Africa 50. And the whole idea then was, let's get more financing for PDAP projects, infrastructure projects. And of course, Africa 50 has been set up, is operational. It is not hosted in the bank, but the bank is a major shareholder and chairs the board. It is operating independently, has got investment from African governments predominantly, and I think now they're trying to get investments from other institutional investors. Now, Africa 50 is supporting purely only infrastructure projects, and their focus is really on PPP type projects. So their focus is projects that are commercially viable, not public sector projects, because the African Development Bank does support public sector projects anyway. So their focus is to enhance more projects that support. But now going forward, this PDA financing strategy we're working on, we will be able to make recommendations on how to scale up, because I do agree, I mean, what we have is not adequate. We need more. We need more financing. Would a dedicated PDA fund or facility help? I think it would. Would it be possible to create it? I should think so. So I think this is something that will have to be looked at by our superiors and African leaders and see how to structure that. But I think the financing strategy which we are going to work on jointly with UNECA and all the key partners around should be able to inform us the impact or whether there is a need for another special facility. So that's really how I look at it. I'm sure Mike would want to add to that. Would you mind?
Yeah, just to say that the issue of creating a special vehicle has a lot of undertaking. You need to look for first of all how to structure such a fund, how to mobilize funding, arrangement to be made, logistical support to be provided, a lot of things. That you need to be careful about in creating new instruments. I think NEPAD IBBF position is very well to be a lead instrument for PDA Part 2, as it was the case for PDA Part 1. So we have a good track record. We have capacity. It's housed by the ADB, which is a funding institute, if not a leading development financing institute on the continent, which fund most of the PDA project and continue will do so on the PDA Part 2. So you do have institutional logistic and institutional arrangement already for supporting PDA Part 2 for your preparation. What we must work on is how to mobilize additional funding into NEPAD IPPF to do more of PDA Part 2 projects. For me, that's the key point. And that's again one thing by Master Mark clearly as part of the funding strategy that ADB will be leading, so that we can channel more resources through existing channels, which make it very clear it has the capacity that is required. So project preparation, the technical issue, not all the institutions can embark on these things successfully. It's a credibility issue as well. You must have a strong institutional track record to do these type of things, and ADB has that. So if you want this to progress, just like we were also, I think if you look at all the project preparation fund, IPPF was number one funding PDA related projects. So we will do so in PDA Part 2. I think for me, the recommendation should be, how do we mobilize additional funding to support NEPAD IPPF to do more of PDA Part 2? That is more strategic to me than trying to advocate or even look at the possibility of creating a separate window. Because we're good at creating new things, but how do we really replenish those things is a serious challenge. Even PDA IBBF has that challenge already, although have a strong track record. So I think that would be my advice here. But the funding strategy will address this issue and make a clear recommendation to support the existing funding instrument rather than creating new ones. We are creating a lot of things, but they are not sustainable in that sense. If I may, since I have the floor, let me take the next question as well. The one from Sunila, the relationship between ADB and NEPAD IPPF, and if all the PDA projects are eligible for funding for the preparation stage. Let me start with the second part of your question. Yes, to confirm that all PDA projects are eligible for funding for project preparation, all of them. So all PDA projects should send a request to NEPAD IPPF, and then we'll use our criteria. Screening criteria and all that assess the eligibility of such. Otherwise, they are all eligible. So that's clear. First part of your question requires you want to know the relationship between ADB and IPPF. NEPAD IPPF is a trust fund created and hosted by the African Development Bank with partners to support the bank's they've had agenda, regional integration agenda and the continental regional integration agenda. And that, again, we can take you back to 2023, when this was this idea was actually floated, when the first NEPAD program came. So it was a bank response to create an instrument that would support or, you know, formalize the bank support to the NEPAD agenda to help prepare projects so that they can attract investment. So IBPF is the bank instrument hosted by the ADB in collaboration with partners, donors that fund this trust fund. For us, it's what we call a special fund because of the NEPAD. And is supported by Canada, which was the first supporter of this fund. Then it was a bilateral fund between the bank and Canada, and later enlarged into multi-donor fund, joined by Germany, DFID, Norway, Denmark, and Spain. That's where we are. So IPPF is a bank instrument created to articulate the bank support to the NEPAD agenda. And also to support the preparation of a regional integration, regional infrastructure project, aiming at strengthening regional integration on the continent. Michira, if you want to add anything to that.
Okay, no, thanks. I think, Mike, you've adequately responded. But maybe just to add that projects that are prepared through NEPAD IPPF support are open for financing by any other financier out there. So they are not tied to the African Development Bank downstream financing. Of course, the bank ends up financing a lot of the projects prepared by NEPAD IPPF. Why? Because they do meet the strategic alignment of the bank anyway and promote regional integration and meet all our most of our high fives. So the bank is one of the major financiers of projects that come out of the NEPAD IPPF project preparation cycle, but not exclusive to the bank. And also just to add that the bank also contributes to the fund, to the NEPAD IPPF fund. So besides the donors, other donors that are contributors to the bank, besides hosting and managing this IPPF, also contributes to the fund. So the bank provides all the personnel, all the administrative base and operations of the IPPF, but also contributes to the fund. So that is a Krishna, Shali, any additional questions?
Yes, Chara, thank you very much for that. We have a question, the name is not known, but the question is...
It's from Faruk, Nigeria.
It's written iPhone. The question is, will AFDB require PCO guarantees for private sector projects in the energy sector? What is the policy of AFDB for priority projects? Yes, Krishna, you're correct. It's Farouk from Nigeria. Jara?
May you repeat the question, Shelley?
Will AFDB require PCOA guarantees for private sector projects in the energy sector? And what is the policy of AFDB for PIDA priority projects?
Right. Thank you. Thank you for that. I may ask the person to basically clarify a bit more what the PCOA is. It guarantees what it means by that for the energy sector, so that we can able to respond correctly. But yeah, in terms of the second part of the question, prioritization of PIDA project, I think this is already our objective, whether in the energy sector, transport sector, as long as this project is a PIDA project, is as a part of included in the PIDA PAP, is definitely prioritized in the bank. It's always the highest level, as I showed in the presentation, the highest level of prioritization is projects that are PIDA. And it's really because they have continental consensus, have gone through a rigorous process to end up in that list. These are the winners for us. So we go first for all those PIDA projects that are prioritized in there. In terms of private sector financing, I did touch upon how we look at projects, what we look for in those projects. The four main criteria I talked about are one, it must demonstrate commercial viability. It must demonstrate development impact. It must be aligned to national and bank strategies. but also we must be able to show that by getting involved in that project, there's additionality that the bank brings into that transaction. And I did say such additionality may include guarantees. Now, from the private sector, because the private sector project, we call them now non-sovereign operations. In other words, we do not need a guarantee from the government to be able to finance a private sector project. It's assessed on its merits, on its factors that I outlined, and also on the strength of the sponsors and track record of the sponsors. So these are the kind of elements that we look for, but do not require a sovereign or a government guarantee to support a private sector investment in that country. I know that answers the question, but you might be open to clarify if that that's really the question you had.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Farouk, your mic is on, so you can further clarify.
Okay, thank you very much. I think the speaker has done a good job in answering the question to a large extent. But the point I was trying to raise is whether or not some of these private sector-led projects, especially in the energy sector, that is perceived to be risky, will still require, the bank will require that they come up with a sovereign-backed put-call option agreements, which is mostly what we are facing right now in Nigeria, where projects that are private sector-led turns out to demand lenders' guarantees for airport terminations. So I wanted to see if probably the PIDA has some kind of model, because I know African Development Bank is one of those banks that has asked for PCOA in some of the potential PPAs that the private sector in Nigeria has signed. So that's the question. The second question is whether there is any cap per country or per project in terms of funding. How much is the ceiling for each country, or there is no ceiling? Thank you.
Right. No, thank you very much. That kind of clarifies the question. Yes, I mean, going to the first part of the question, if a private investor is investing in an energy project, obviously that energy will be sold to an off-taker. Any financier wants to ensure that the right agreements are in place to ensure that the power is actually sold and sold at a commercially acceptable price, etc. And the power purchase agreements are a prerequisite, I would say, in financing any energy sector project. Of course, certain jurisdictions will allow generation of power to third-party off-takers, which are not national utilities or governments. Those arrangements obviously also require agreements to be in place to be able to secure financing. So I'm sure this is one of the requirements that the bank will be looking for. Otherwise, it does not provide any security or guarantee that this this power actually has an off-taker at an agreed time. So, but again, I think it's on a case-by-case basis. We need to look at the factors surrounding the project. What is the legislative environment within which this project is being undertaken, and the financial standing of the off-taker is also of critical importance. Because it's not just a signed PPA, but we have also to ensure that the off-taker is actually of good financial standing. I know we have Enjeda here. Enjeda is a colleague who just recently retired from the bank, from our energy sector, many years of experience. So I think if Enjeda would like to say something to add to this, we are welcome to do so. And Mike, of course. The other question, let me just quickly answer the second part. Does the bank has a cap for financing of projects per country, per project? So the point is that, yes, in every country that we operate, depending on the type of project, remember that we have countries that are categorized based on their economic standing, their GDP. We have low-income countries, we have middle-income countries. We also have countries that are graduating from low-income to middle-income, so they are in the middle. And we have different instruments that we can apply to finance in each of those countries. So for each country, we normally would have an assessment of its capacity to borrow. Why? We want to ensure that any lending we provide is sustainable, sustainable in the sense that the country will be able to take on those debts and be able to repay sustainably. Because as you know, this is a very, very important point, not to encumber our countries with huge loans that they will not be able to repay. So we do have our own limits that we calculate based on the current status of the application. If it is a purely private sector project, obviously the recipient of the lending is most cases not the government. So we will look also at the credibility of that lender, the commercial structure of the project, and so on. So it will not be necessarily be linked or limited by the capacity of the country to borrow, because in this case, the borrower would be a private sector investment. We have caps per project. Yes, if it's a private sector project, we finance only up to 1/3 of the cost of the project. For public sector projects, I don't think we have a cap per se. We finance based on the resources available to that country for that public sector project, and can go up to 90%, with, of course, we normally would require the recipient to also make a counterpart contribution to the project. So if it's public, the limits are limited by the resource envelope that we have for that country. And depending on the project, it's private sector, it's up to 1/3. But again, in all cases, we'll look at the risk assessment and what we think are lending sustainable limits that we normally work out for each country. I don't know if Mike, you want to add to this, or Enjeda, you might want something more to on the energy side.
Thank you, Michira. Just a word or two on this put and call option that one of our participants has requested. Michira, as you have very well explained, the bank provides a partial risk guarantee to backstop off-taker defaults for PPAs. So that would substantially, of course, mitigate off-takers' risk and could encourage investors to invest in energy projects in Africa. But this partial risk guarantee has its own limitation, because the amount of the guarantee could be, for example, a 3 or 6 months sales amount. Like, for example, if the off-taker defaults to pay for the electricity consumed for 6 months, that amount for the PRG could cover for that. But what happens if the off-taker continue to default, and to the extent that the business cannot be viable, then the investors may want to terminate the project and leave. In that case, the put and call option would provide for the host government to pay for the to guarantee to pay the investment for the investor. So this will not really depend on the bank, but different countries have different possibilities. I know many countries have been resisting to full option. So what I want to say, this will be on case by case basis and would require, you know, a policy and regulatory reform in different countries to attract more private sector investment, so that the countries would be willing to provide this kind of guarantee, the PCOA, to include the PCOA clause in their financing agreement. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Enjeda, for those valuable contributions. I'm not sure if Mike is still on the call, but if he is, if there's anything you want to add, Mike? If not, Shali, Krishna, any further questions?
Yeah, we can move to the next question from Dr. Feriwot.
Yes, the question is the selection of NEPAD IPPF
made in parallel with or sequential to PDAPAP2 screening. And after this, then Gilbert and Dr. Diafala, you can intervene.
So if I understood the question, is that it says that is a selection of NEPA and IPVF done sequential to PDAPAP2?
Yes.
Or in parallel. Actually, maybe the question is it for PDAPAP2 projects which are being submitted now? I guess we need to look at the definition of PDAPAP2 actually. PDAPAP2 is the shortlist, the actual shortlist. And that shortlist, the official version of it, will only be known after the Heads of State Summit next year. So my view is that it will be sequential. So it can only selection for Nepal IPPF can only happen after it is formally approved next year. So what are you, maybe Chira, you can
yes. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. So I was a bit lost in the question. Yes. So the reality is that the process now is submission of projects for consideration into PDAPAP2. When the submission closes end of this month of June, there will be a process to screen all the submissions, rank them according to the selection criteria that is been put in place, and come up with a list of at least 50 projects as agreed by our leaders on the content of PDAPAP2. NEPAD IPPF continues to operate. Currently has got projects that we're working on in NEPAD IPPF, most of which are also PDA projects from the current phase of PDA. Once the list is adopted, the PDAPAP2 list is adopted, expected to be in January next year, then submission for preparation begins. So, like I said, the NEPAD IPPF receives submissions throughout the year. I mean, it is not to say that a project being submitted today into the for consideration PDAPAP2 cannot be submitted to the NEPAD IPPF for preparation. I think there's nothing to stop that as long as it's a regional project, meets the criteria, it can be submitted, but not as a PDAPAP2 project. The only decision of which projects constitute PDAPAP2 will be taken after adoption in January 2021. Thank you.
Thank you, Chara. Gilbert, and then Dr. Diafala, please. The floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much, Mr. Chiro, for a very clear presentation on funding. I have two small areas for clarification. One on the upstream project preparation, the other one is on project implementation. With regard to projects, in fact, during the STAP which is the NEPAD STAP, the short term action plan, and even also with the PDAPAP2, there was the issue of project readiness in terms of project documentation was very important, so that there was need for resources to undertake a project preparation. Now you have indicated that, of course, under IPPF, and also under other, you are also coordinating other project preparation facilities in Africa. What is your view about the trends in the availability of resources to undertake this, the project preparation? Because it's important. Otherwise, when we just have project ideas, we may not move very far in terms of uptake. I know, of course, as you said, the IPPF is not only for PDA projects, but they can also be applied for the projects in direct master plans. From information obtained last year, it looked like our partners like the EU were no longer willing to provide funding for project preparation. So that's why I wanted to know what do you think are the trends in the availability of resources for project preparation. And then On the downstream, the project implementation, again, it looks like partners, cooperating partners, are looking more at blending and are no longer willing to finance the project in full. I know you have said, for example, you have no limit in how much you finance a project, especially if it is a public sector project. So this aspect of blending is going to be very important, and the capacity, you know, it's important that the countries and the regs understand that blending will be important in order to be able to aggregate resources to complete the financing of projects downstream. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Gilbert, and good to hear from you. Shali, do we respond to this, or you want to take the other question first?
I think since it was long, I think it's better to respond.
Yeah. Okay. So indeed, Gilbert, you correctly observed the NEPAD short-term action plan, which I'm familiar with from those days, was pretty much a wish list of projects. Projects were just put together without any institutional arrangements to back them or any prior preparation activity or upstream activity taken to put it together. So eventually it became very difficult to achieve the implementation of most of those staff projects. And we need, I think we've learned lessons from that. When we developed PIDA phase one, approved 2012, I think we tried to ensure that these projects have clear ownership, have at least some early stage work to move them from an idea to some concepts done, so that we are able to ensure they move. Of course, again, we can look back to PIDA phase one and see that there are projects that haven't moved since being approved in 2012, and there are various reasons for that, which I won't try and belabor. So indeed, as we prepare phase two, you will notice that the PIDA phase two selection criteria has very detailed way of assessing projects for readiness, one. And also we have criteria to assess attractiveness for private sector. And why is that? Because of the whole issue also you talked about of blending. We are saying that there isn't sufficient money. Well, sometimes the argument is there's the money is not the limit, it's good projects that are lucky. Yeah. But the reality is we still have a financing gap in Africa to close our financing infrastructure investment requirements. So we need to attract as many financiers that are interested in these projects as possible. And blending, if a project has got potential to attract private money, let's try our best to blend financing and bring additional money from private resources, because then that allows public sector resources to go to new or additional projects. So indeed, there's a lot of interest from partners to ensure that there is blending wherever possible, but that is not stopping projects moving ahead where there is no blending. Project preparation resources are not adequate, I can tell you. The landscape, there are many players. Some are specific in a sector, like renewable energy, for example, has quite a number of players interested to help preparation of those. And regional projects are unique. There are not many project preparation facilities specifically for regional projects. NEPAD IPPF is one unique one that's only looking at regional projects. But we also have the NEPAD SDM, the NEPAD Service Delivery Mechanism, whose role is really way upstream. So the NEPAD SDM is set up to support creating the enabling environment that you talked about, the institutional architecture behind the project, ensuring that the agreements, inter-country agreements, MOUs are signed, are in place, and helping the owners of those projects to develop terms of reference to procure services to help them package the project, undertake early stage feasibility before a project matures to fall into a detailed feasibility design structuring phase. So the NEPAD SDM is set up purely for that. I'm aware that they have limited resources as well. That's a challenge we have all over. I think we must do our best to try and secure more resources into the project preparation space. And this is, I think, a task that we have to ensure that PDAP projects can actually move fast through the preparation phase. So we are partnering as NEPAD IPPF, like I said, with several other PPFs through the what we call the Project Preparation Facilities Network, including resources from the World Bank, like the Global Infrastructure Facility, GIF, also has the resources, and we are a technical partner for GIF to be able to channel resources from the GIF to infrastructure projects. But of course, they are interested more in projects that have a potential for private sector investment downstream. So I think there's still work to be done, to answer your question. There isn't enough money for Project PREP, but we need to do our best to ensure that the best projects do secure financing from the multiple sources available. Thank you.
Thank you, Mchara. Dr. Jafala, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. I thank Mr. Kirwa for the presentation. And I have two questions. I see that in the ICT sector, the private sector really had involved very well, and now they start getting involved in the energy sector. But in the transport sector, the private sector, especially the African and other private sector, they are not really involved much in financing the transport projects. If the bank discussed this issue, why the private sector is not involved too much in financing the transport sector, and what is the reason, and how do they encourage them to get in, because the demand for infrastructure investment is very huge, very big, so that we need the private sector from the continent and outside, especially in the transport, to get in. So I want to know what you have done to get the private sector to put more money in the infrastructure development. The second question, in meetings, conferences, every people, they say that the money is there, but where is the project? Financing is there, where is the project? This means there is not available bankable project or good projects for the investors to get in, which means that we need capacity building on member countries so that we have good bankable projects constructed and well done to get the investors to get in. And also we need to look at the technology transfer. How do we get that one to reduce the cost of the infrastructure project implementation, because the cost is very high of infrastructure in Africa compared to Asia. The difference, I think, between Asia and Africa is around 30%. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dafala, and good to hear from you again. And pertinent issues that you raised there, I must be honest. The transport sector, indeed, is not at the moment attracting as much private investment as ICT energy in that order. However, there are subsectors of transport that are proving more attractive. We have ports, for example, that are of quite interest to private investors, and we have the airports as well that have been showing an interest in private sector. I think it's a twofold issue. One, it is really a matter of the investment climate in countries that are implementing these projects. How open are they for private sector investments in the transport sector? What is the legal and regulatory environment there for private investment in infrastructure? We find that certain countries are advanced, others are not, and you tend to see more investment in those projects that are more advanced. There are a couple of them in West Africa, in Southern Africa, East and North Africa that we know are having a lot of investment in transport. The second level is the project itself, how the project is structured. And transport, most of the projects, whether it's highways or railroads, rail networks, sometimes you find that the structure is not the structure of the project is not attractive, sufficiently attractive to bring on board private sector, because you still need the public sector role. And if the legal and regulatory environment is not there, or the it's not going to fly. There will be a pathway, so to speak, from potential investors. And secondly, the issue of traffic volumes. There are a couple of projects that I've been working on in rail, for example, where we're trying to bring in private sector. But there's need to structure the project because the viability, commercial viability, the traffic volumes would not be attractive today for someone to invest private money in, because they will not be able to recoup that money in several years. So the structure would need to be in such a way that the public sector also takes a significant level of risk in the financial structure of the project to be able to close the viability gap that might be there in the project. So it's a multiplicity of issues, I think, for transport sector. One, how do we open up the other subsectors that are not attracting, especially roads? Do we want to create more toll roads? Is there sufficient traffic? If there isn't sufficient traffic, how does the public sector cushion the potential impact of that over the years that the traffic builds up? For subsectors that are already attracted private sector, like ports, airports, for example, how do we have ensure that the environment in that country, the regulatory environment, actually is open and attractive enough, and there's capacity within the country? One thing that we are doing as a bank, you asked what we're doing, we are actually now developing an internal framework for PPPs in the bank, an operational framework. Why? Because we think we need to do more to support countries throughout the process. So from early stage, where they're creating the legal framework, the institutional framework, through the capacity development within the country, through to identification of a pipeline of projects in all these key sectors, and preparing those projects and structuring them down to investing in the implementation of those projects. So that's what we're trying to do, to help countries build capacity, build the skills necessary, and where necessary, even hire skilled expertise, advisory firms that are experienced to help them put together the structures necessary. And there are certain countries that are already showing very, very good emerging results, Senegal, maybe Cote d'Ivoire in West Africa, Ghana, in the east of Kenya, Ethiopia also moving towards there. So there are certain countries that are showing a lot of potential for that. I think there's more to be done. And I agree, we need to try and assist these countries, all the countries, to be able to, if they have the will and the interest to bring on board private sector.
Thank you, Chair, for that. Two last questions. The first one is from Jonas. He's asking, are there cases where NEPAD IPPF fund can finance implementation projects or not? And the last one is from Suela. What about the PDAPAP 2 projects that were adopted but not implemented? Will AFD them as well?
The question is about the PAP 1 projects.
Yes, well, sorry. What about the PDAPAP 1 projects that were adopted but not implemented? Will AFDB support them as well?
Right. Thank you for those two. UNES, NEPAD IPPF, can it support implementation? The answer is no. NEPAD IPPF supports only preparation. So right from pre-feasibility, feasibility, detailed design, preparing bidding documents, until financial close, until the project secures financing. So we can, NEPAD IPPF can accompany or support a project to even do investment round tables to help hire a structuring firm, to help them structure financing, whether it's from public or from private, until the project reaches financial close. That is where NEPAD IPPF's mandate ends. Once that happens, the implementation phase is taken up by other partners, which could be the African Development Bank, like I said, but also could be other financiers. So that's how the NEPAD IPPF operations are structured. How about PDAPAP 1 projects? Will the banks that are not implemented, will the bank finance them? Yes, of course. PDAPAP 1 doesn't end by adoption of PDAPAP 2, I would say. Of course, there are projects that will graduate into PDAPAP 2. In other words, I think countries are already submitting certain projects that way in PDAPAP 1, submitting them for consideration under PDAPAP 2, because the selection criteria for PDAPAP 2 is slightly different from the selection criteria that was used for PDAPAP 1. So that project has to go through the selection process of PDAPAP 2 to make sure it aligns with the integrated corridor approach, et cetera, to fit into PDAPAP 2. If it fits into PDAPAP 2, it will be adopted, of course, for implementation in the coming years. But the projects that were adopted in PDAPAP 1 but have not been implemented and will not be adopted in PDAPAP 2, if those projects are still priorities and are still submitted and there's evidence through our due diligence to show that this project has a high impact, is still a priority, we have commitment from the countries to implement, definitely the African Development Bank will still finance projects like those and any others that are viable projects but may not be in PDAPAP 2. So the answer is yes, but the key, I think, is really the interest, because you will see, like I was saying, there are projects that are in PDAPAP 1, adopted 2012, have not moved. This is 2020, 8 years later. So one of the key issues we say, if a project is in PDA, it's a priority. But if it is a priority, why should it take 8 years or more without any movement? That may show you that it is no longer a priority, because I don't see how a country or countries that have a high interest in a particular project, which is in PDAPAP, have not done anything to ensure that the project moves, secures financing for preparation, secures financing for investment. So sometimes we know that priorities change over time. Sometimes we have a change of governments who may be promoting a particular project. When a government changes, maybe the priorities are new, and you find that a project is lagging. That is the role that we need for regional economic communities, to go back and revalidate continuously with their member countries whether these projects are still priorities. If they are priorities, then definitely we'll secure financing and downstream. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. That's all from my side. But Higgs, I'm encouraging you to put your contact information in the chat box.
Hello?
Yes, nope. Mike, go on. Yes, go on, Mike.
Yes, sorry. No, I mean, thank you very much for the questions and answers. The couple of issues I would like to come back to. One was on the issue of private sector financing. Why do we see that in ICT and not in transport and so on? I'm sure I have given a good response. I just want to say that, we have published a very good report, which is the ICA Infrastructure Financing Trend for 2018, which really focused on this issue. You'll see in that report that it was already released, I think, November last year, that we have gone down to look at the profile of the sector, look at why, private sector is here, not there. Typically, you will know that the sectors have different profiles. One key thing that you know that drives private sector investment is revenue, is profit making. Let's just be blunt about it. It's revenue. So whether the project or sector is revenue generating high enough to compensate for the risk that the private sector will take, that's a big question, and that's what allow a private sector to make investment. So ICT sector, as you noted yourself, not all the subsectors of ICT has also attracted private sector. If you take the fixed telephone line, there was barely no private sector investment over there because it was not revenue generated, actually it's very low, and then it was not attracted to private sector. But as soon as we introduced mobile telecom, then the revenue profile increased, then it became attractive to private sector, and then government just need to put regulation in place to attract more. So, there we didn't have to do much in the ICT sector to attract private sector because the business model was actually very, very good for them. Revenue generating, subsector, mobile, internet, and so on. But fixed line was dead because there was no, private sector investment. But as soon as we opened up for mobile, because these are by nature revenue generating, so it was enough revenue to compensate for their risk. So the risk return profile of those investments was very clear. And that's what attracted the private sector to the point that today again, ICA report pointed to that. The gap in ICT is close to zero. I think in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll close the gap. The gap here for us means that the backbone, the real backbone that needs to be there for private sector to come. Private sector, again, you know, don't invest. Yeah, private sector, they don't invest in backbone. That's, again, left to government. But thankfully, I think government have been very proactive. They have closed almost the big backbones investment. I think we will be able, if this trend continue, to close the gap in ICT in the next 3-4 years to come, which is a good news. So the second best sector that is very good for private sector also because of the model and the revenue generating aspect is energy. You know, and again, not all the energy sector, you need to break it down. You need to be granular about these things. If you look at electricity power generation, it has been opened up because of regulation. There, it becomes revenue generating business because IPPs, independent power producer, can set up their plant, produce power, sign a take or pay contract, and completely offload this to the public utilities. They will pay whether they consume or not. So that actually allow private sector to step in because again, it's revenue generating and enough to compensate for their risk. The same for power distribution. It's also very, very attractive sector, subsector for private sector because of the same reason as power generation. But if you go to power transmission, again, the energy sector, you barely see private sector. They are not there because electricity power transmission is just potentially revenue generating. It's not revenue generating. You know. But it's a very modest or non-return for private sector, this type of investment. So there you will not see them. And unless you, again, be creative about a business model there, we see that in other regions. I mean, I think in Latin America, you've seen a lot of transmission line energy being, financed by private sector because of the business model that they've introduced. It's not common, but it's actually gaining ground in those regions. And it's something that we are actually start thinking about at the bank to see how do we make transmission sector to be attracted to private sector. Because if the generation is privatized, distribution is also privatized, transmission of power still mostly public sector affair, you know, again, because of the regulation and also the strategic nature of it, because you don't want the private sector to actually have a monopoly of your electricity power transmission. But nevertheless, other countries are opened up for that. It has to be strictly regulated, and then that can be attractive enough for private sector. Transport is the last sector, because transport by nature is not revenue generating infrastructure asset. This is public good. It must be there, road must be there for us to move from A to B, you know, whether it's a village or a town, there must be connectivity. There must be, you know, a network of road available. That one is heavily public sector generating, particularly trunk roads, you know, and then the bridges. So you don't want to block people because of economic reason or financial reason for people to actually use the bridge, which is the only way for them to cross a river. So you have to be careful about that. But if you look at the toll road, I think Chira mentioned that, and then the airport and port, it's revenue generating activity. It has turned to be because of the, you know, guarantee and the risk aspect that government have worked very hard on to guarantee those traffic risk that Michira was referring to, and also the guarantee that's behind. And that's where the bank also is doing a lot of effort to keep those subsectors attractive for private sector to bridge the gap. Port, airport, high revenue generating, you know, significantly attractive for private sector. Same with some toll road and bridges, but railway, although it's revenue generating in most part of the thing, it's still not competitive enough in our part of the continent to have private sector. So there's a lot of work to be done in the rail sector, trunk road, and some bridges for us to arrive at attracting private sector. But naturally, ICT led the way for private sector because of the business model, revenue generating, it's purely liberalized, and energy sector is also going the same route. So the next one we see will follow heavily will be transport, and then water remains the biggest gap and the biggest complicated because of issue of financial sustainability, you know, low tariff issues, operational maintenance issue in water sector. So those are the things that we are struggling with to make this fourth sector, economically viable and particularly financially viable, commercially viable for private sector. But it's a long road. Luckily for us, we have a good lesson to learn from ICT and energy to some extent, which can be translated into transport and water as well. But I strongly recommend that you look at the ICA Infrastructure Consortium for Africa, the latest report, which dwelt into this issue of private sector financing of infrastructure, which sector is gaining momentum, why, and then which one is lagging behind. I just wanted to bring that and then highlight, refer you to that report. The next one is going to be published hopefully by the end of this year. It's a yearly report, and both AU and NAPAD are members of the ICA. So this is also a report that PIDA will benefit a great deal of. So this is what I wanted to just add to what you thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I guess there are no further questions in the chat box, no hands raised. But maybe I would like to summarize and actually raise a suggestion to the RECs. I think thank you, our colleagues from the African Development Bank have really provided very clear answers to all these questions. Very specific questions in the financing of project, which was very helpful for everybody. Thank you for this. And I would like to maybe to come back to two things actually, which were raised, two very important messages that came out. Actually, one which came out, which Mike announced that one of the milestones of NEPAD IPPF is that 75% of the funding would go to PIDA, and then the other thing maybe we didn't it was touched upon is that the PIDA PAP 2 is different, has been improved compared to PIDA PAP 1 because in a number of ways. One, it's integrated development corridor, that is we tend to superpose, to have an overlap of several infrastructure projects from several sectors to achieve synergy. Second is the economic impact and inclusive dimensions, job creation, gender, climate, and all that. And thirdly, most importantly, I think there's a strong, now it's a filtered list, a curated, prioritized list based on the selection criteria. So the end result, that shortlist is already the best, most ready, highest impact projects. So my question to the REC, actually, to AFDB and the advice actually, which for the REC would be, since because PIDA PAP 2 is such so aligned, so focused, and because the NEPAD will now focus 75% of their resources on PIDA projects, then it makes a strong case for the RECs to ensure that all their key projects, all their priority projects are actually within PIDA. So the specific question, Mike and Chilwell, is does it help the REC to make sure that their projects are in PIDA PAP 1 because of this 75% milestone or threshold, that rather than let it be in their master plan and still compete and still apply for the funds to PPF. Over to you.
Well, yes, Krishna, if I understood your question, does it help for the project to be in PIDA than in the REC master plan? I think yes. PIDA is always the first level of prioritization for continental projects. So if it is PDA, it has a very, very high chance of securing financing much earlier than a project that is not in PDA. That should be the incentive, really, of having this PDA path, because then all financiers, not just the African Development Bank, should look to PDA first, because this is the African-owned agenda, priority projects, going through all this process of selection. So that's the highest tier, I think. I don't know if that's actually the question you asked.
If I may add to the response, I think it's very important to keep alignment in this continental infrastructure program. You know, PDA PAP 2 projects should not be a different priority than in the regional direct master plan. It should not be. You know, it's there's a hierarchy that we're trying to look at here. Here we're talking about continental integration, which is, you know, which goes through regional integration and would support countries' national priority. So you must cascade this down. You know, continental, you can take it from top down or bottom up approach. But for me, it should be a bottom up approach. So any direct master plan has to integrate countries' priority. At the end of the day, projects are financed by the countries, government. You must have one or two, three government to take a loan from the bank or other banks. You know, otherwise you can have the ambition at the highest level, but it's not gonna go anywhere. So again, to come back to the question raised by a colleague before, why some of the projects are stuck, is because no country is willing to take a loan for it. That's it. You know, PDA PAP project should not be developed as nihilo. It has to be a part of, you know, country's priority, elevated to regional priority, hence has to feature in the master plan. And then we now take it from there to be what we call PDA project. So PDA project is just a result of national priority, elevated at the regional priority to come at what we now, we just took some of them that we think are transformational enough for continent as a whole to address as a, you know, as a priority. That's it. So this alignment must be clearly articulated as RECs are picking projects. We don't want any project that is not part of the RECs, master plan. If that's the case, I think that project will be score zero in my view, you know, because I don't see how you can justify the strategic importance. That order, continental level is important, but in my region, for region, it's not important because I don't know where that project will be implemented. And then if you say it's not important in a region, you automatically saying that it's not important in a country. Hence, that project is just an idea that someone put over there that does not fit into national development plan, neither is it in a regional master plan. So we need to be careful. Rex should take note of this, that we don't want to go back to what we experienced in PDA PAP 1. You know, if projects are stuck over there, it's because there's no ownership on this project. It was just pulled there as a list, and then nobody owns it. It's not part of national development plan of Gabon or Cameroon. So how do we go and do that bridge? We can't. It can be a PDA project we can talk about as a PDA priority, but it's not national priority. If it's not national priority, I don't see how ICAS will make it as their priority. Because ICAS does not take a loan to finance a project. It's Gabon and Cameroon, ultimately, that will take a loan. So it has to be bottom-up approach. PDA here is just the framework that we say, okay, we're going to look at regional priority, with themselves informed by national priority, and pick 10 per region and make it what we call continental priority project. If we do this, we are advancing the continent across all the region, across all the sector. So that alignment is very important for me. And as a task force, we have to make sure that there are criteria is really look at this thing in a rigorous manner. And because it has implication for mobilizing financing, even at the preparation level, because we will not use IPPF resources for any PDA PAP 2 project. That does not come from REC master plan. That does not come from national development priority. Because if you do that, you're throwing money out, that project will be prepared and it's just gonna stay on the shelf. No government has planned for this, and it's not gonna be a project that will be downstream financed. So that alliance is important. I just want to be clear that the right should take note of this. And then countries also should be aware that it's not ex nihilo. It has to be a part of national and regional master plans. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Mike, for reminding us this need for bottom-up country ownership and being part of a REC master plan. And I would like to remind that this is a mandatory criteria, actually, eligibility criteria to be either part of a REC master plan or part of showing strong commitment of the participating countries through some demonstrated agreement form. So I think if there are no other questions, I guess we've reached the end of this webinar. Some members have commitments, have to leave, have already left actually. So Mike, maybe the last, would you like to conclude? Last word? Yeah.
Again, just to thank colleagues, I think it was a very fruitful meeting. Sorry, I joined in the middle. I'm chair. Started. I'm currently in two meetings, but that's the way it is. And I think we had a good discussion. It's good for us to talk like this and then clarify some things and then also learn from colleagues to inform whatever we are doing. So this is a very good topic for me. And we'll look forward to the French version, which hopefully we'll have, I think it's on Thursday, again with colleagues from the Francophone country. But otherwise, yeah, I think I just want to thank participants on the thank and cheer up and also share a few words. But also thanking him for the good presentation and yourself, Krishna, for coordinating all this. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Yep, just to echo the same, really thank you to all colleagues. It's been a very, very enriching, interactive discussion. Maybe we should have more of these in the future. To thank Krishna, Shali, and all the AUC team, and all the participants, really, for such an engaging discussion. Thank you very much, and we'll be meeting as we go ahead with this Peter Pap 2 process. Thank you. Krishna, over to you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mchira. Just to let you know, tomorrow we're having the regional session for COMESA, which includes actually four regions. There are countries from four regions, except from ECOWAS. All the other regions have member states from COMESA. So we invite, we have quite a few COMESA members already connected today. So we invite you all to join tomorrow. Very important session for discussions between the REC and member states. And also please, all of you who have projects from RECs, member states, please talk to your REC and do your data entry. Register if you're not registered on the website. We only have 57 projects to date on the website, which is way below what we were targeting. So please don't wait for the last minute. We only have 20 days left to the deadline. So please, as soon as possible, make your project visible so that we can see, we can comment. I can see that some of our experts like Engeda has been posting comments on projects, which is very helpful because then he raises the questions which member states or project owners can work on. I would invite the other experts, Jonas, Dr. Dapala, and Gilbert, Mikey. Maybe if you could do the same for your in your sectors, in especially those projects which you know already. Please go for the projects, and if you see something which is missing or needed, you can post a comment, and then that would be helpful for the project owners and the rest as well. It's a way of communication, actually. Since time is of the essence, we don't have much time. Posting it there, it makes it visible and everybody can react and add value and improve, fill in the gaps. Okay, so if no other comments, I would we will close the meeting here. Thank you again very much for your patience and participation and active participation, and hope to see you for the COMESA members tomorrow. And as from next week, we are planning a dedicated energy thematic, sustainable energy access, and also we will have the ECAS regional webinar next week, next Wednesday. Thank you, and see you soon. Maybe Abdu, you want to say something? Yes, go on, Abdu. Yeah.
No, please. No. It's all right, Krishna. It's all right. I'm just saying bye. We'll talk tomorrow, hopefully.
Thank you, Colin.
Tomorrow.
Thank you.
Have a great week. Charlie. Have a great day. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.